All right, we're on the line with Gary Major, who was at WKLO in Louisville for a great deal of the 70s as a DJ and also in other positions. Gary, when exactly did you come to WKLO?
I came to WKLO on September 14th in 1973 from Norfolk, Virginia, at a balls-to-walls rock and roll QRK station there, and came in as nighttime disc jockey the very same day in this market, and this means only to this marketplace and people into country music, which is the very same day that Coyote Calhoun started in Louisville.
Wow, you were there the same day that Coyote started.
Right? Oh, yeah, and then it even gets better. Johnny Randolph is the one who gave me the tip about the job at WKLO.
Wow.
He had an opening. I called him. He said, "Oh, man, mine's filled, but understand WKLO across the street has an opening. You may want to check there."
And so nights meant what hours exactly?
At that point, it was 6 to 10 p.m.
Okay, who did you replace at WKLO?
J.J. Wright.
Okay.
J.J. went to WRKO in Boston, which at that time was one of the Drake rock and rollers. So.
And had a big career up there and also in other stations in the Boston market.
Yeah.
All right. Where did you work in radio before coming to WKLO besides the station you mentioned?
No, the first station I worked for, and we'll mention this only in passing, was WCOW in Sparta, Wisconsin. It was owned by people who owned a feed and grain store and didn't know squat from broadcasting. I was there about 4 weeks because my car wouldn't start. It was in the winter in Wisconsin. When the car started the next morning, I went to the bank, withdrew my escape money, and escaped.
Hey, it was that bad, huh?
Oh, yeah. It was just, you know, first job away from home. Just I was 19 at the time. Just didn't quite click with everything that needed to be done in my life. Went back, and then the official real job was WLRC in Whitehall, Michigan, which is just north of Muskegon. Sleepy town in the wintertime. In the summertime, tourist trade swells a town of about 5,000 up to someplace around 40,000 or 50,000 in the summertime, or at least used to. Was there for 9 months. Started out as, you know, disc jockey, and ended up doing traffic while I was on the air. Ended up doing scheduling commercial traffic on the air. Did a little bit of everything. Ended up being program director because, gee, I understood music, and nobody there did. So went to WSAM in Saginaw, hometown. That was the era in the late 60s. If you had call letters that made a name, you were that. So I was Sammy Major.
Mm-hmm.
If you were in East Lansing, Michigan, there was WJIM, so everybody else was Jim, and was there for about 2.5 years. Started out as nighttime disc jockey, went to afternoon drive, program director. And the thing at that radio station was, at that time, we did a lot of broadcast remotes. I spent the last 14 months that I was there on remote at the same place.
Wow.
Which was Michigan Mobile Homes. And that's an area that you had a lot of folks who bought mobile homes. And the criteria to renew the contract for $375 a week for the afternoon drive program was if they sold more mobile homes from this week, from a year ago this week, matching sales, then they'd renew me for another week. So I finally had to go in. To do an air check, I actually had to tell one of my part-timers on the weekend to take a Saturday off so I could do some air checks, so I could get out of there. So I ended up going across the street to WKNX, which is a 10,000-watt daytimer, and the second week I was there, I'm back at Michigan Mobile Homes because the salesman went in and said, "Now we've got him now, you know." Only problem is when you have one radio station that primarily has a white-collar audience, one has a blue-collar audience. Blue-collar audience bought mobile homes. White-collar folks bought homes in the suburbs.
Yeah.
Didn't sell a mobile home that week, so I was only there a week, thank goodness. Ended up a music director there, was there from until 1972, and went for 8 weeks to a, you know, just sometimes there are times in life we make decisions. I had a sales manager who was a really good guy, had been out to his house many times, and sit around drinking one night, and he said, "So what happens if Dick Hamilton becomes program director?" I said, "I turn in my notice." So the following Monday, it was announced that Dick Hamilton was going to become program director, and I promptly turned in my notice, and it's like, "Oh, yeah, I bought a house here. Where I need to find a job?"
Yeah, really.
So I went to a radio station in Midland, Michigan for 8 weeks and had a run-in with a general manager, and in one of those unique situations where the general manager had been a major market jock and would hotline you every break.
Oh, man.
Literally. I didn't like the way you said that. Oh, too bad. Deal with it. We had a studio situation. The perfect broadcast studio is every time you key your microphone, they'll make the studio door locks.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay? So you can either leave it so it'll lock or it'll be unlocked. And he called me at 6 o'clock in the morning. The fellow who was supposed to do a Saturday morning shift called me at about 5:30 and said, "I can't make it. I'm sick." So I drove a 35-minute trip in about 20 minutes, went on the air, and about the third song I get hotlined, and the fourth song I get hotlined, and by the fifth song I said, "I'm putting the phone on hold, don't call me again, don't want to deal with you." So he comes into the radio station, of course, I've taken the only key we have to the door inside the studio, keyed the microphone, and for 4 hours he sat and glared at me through a window. So before he could say, "You're fired," I walked out and I said, "Here's my two-week notice." So I ended up having Sala was putting together a radio station in Virginia that I mentioned, and his station he'd been working for was a sister station of the station I had just recently left when Dick Hamilton became program director, and the fella suggested he track me down. He tracked me down on my second-to-last day in that two-week period, so I'd quit two jobs without any place to go in about 3 months, and ended up at QRK in Norfolk and ended up there as music director and then program director because the consultants, they went, when you have a radio station, have consultants in, you know you're in trouble first off. And then when the consultants start copywriting everything they're doing for you so that they own the copyrights on your product, you know you're in trouble.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
They found out that's what was going on. So they were ousted. And even though I was the consultant person brought in by the consultants, I was made program director and was there for a period of time. And then I had a falling out and ended up at WKLO.
Yeah. And you were there for a good long time, huh?
I was there 6 years to the day.
And didn't you stay with the company after that?
Well, then when they went through the transition from WKLO to KJ100, and then I left during that transition 3 years later, chief engineer calls me and said, you know, they need a program director here, and you really, this is your job. This is the type of people you want to work for now. The Dick Ferry was the general manager then. I called him. And he said, no, I just hired a fellow that used to work for me in someplace in Pennsylvania, but he needs a morning man because the morning man just quit. So I came in with my tape. He listened to one break, and the general manager looked at the program director and said, this is your new morning man.
Hmm.
So I ended up doing mornings, did middays, did production. I was there for a total of 12 and a half years for Great Trails.
All right, when you got there in 1973, who were some of the other jocks that were on the staff at the time?
Well, Bill Love was morning man. Tom Kennedy was the midday fella. The greatest production director in the world, Mike Rivers, was afternoon drive. Ron Lake did nights. If I remember correctly, the overnight person at that time was Johnny Williams, who then was replaced by Dan Mason, who then ended up being president of CBS Radio, not directly from WKLO, of course. We were top 40 at the corner of 3rd and Walnut Street, Showcase Studio Windows.
And what was that like? Had you worked in Showcase Studios before, besides working at the mobile home place?
No, I not had worked in Showcase Studios, but I had worked so many remotes out in public, so you're used to having distractions. The difference on a Showcase Studio window is, you know, when you're doing 6 to 10 at night, the high school kids think, that's cool. Let's go by and moon Gary tonight. or let's go by and flash the first night story. I go in. I hadn't been on the air for about 6 weeks. And I said, well, you know, I really would like to get a couple of shifts on the board before I'm actually on the air. So, you know, you want to come in tonight, work from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. I'll call my part-timer and call him off. Show up 2 a.m. in the morning. About 3 o'clock in the morning, one of the ladies of the evening walks by and waves. And about an hour later, she walks by and waves, and she's holding a flower for me. I'm a new guy in town, so she's got a flower for me. We had double-locked doors. I go out, hi, you're new in town, and I just thought I'd give you a flower. But she pulled the flower up by the roots from the Louisville Water Company. It was not unusual. I mean, downtown Louisville had its seedy side, and we were just close enough to the seedy side that when you're on the air in any shift, you would see something unusual happen,
Yeah. Usually
every day.
All right, WKLO was a top 40 radio station. Who was the program director that hired you?
Robin Walker, who had just replaced Bill Hennis.
Okay.
Bill Hennis built that station. I mean, with Terrell Matheny, Bill Hennis was the one who really got into the battles with Johnny Randolph on things. And I grew up in Michigan. In 1963, I can remember delivering the Detroit Free Press in the morning, listening to Bill Hennis, then Wild Willie, on WTAC, WTAC in Flint, Michigan.
So, mm-hmm. Now, what kind of changes did Robin Walker make to the radio station? I'm sure you'd heard of air checks at the station before, but it was really a kind of a Drake format and lots of boogie and all that kind of stuff. And what happened with Robin Walker as program director? Did he keep up the same type of intensity with the jocks, the same types of delivery, same jingles, or what kind of changes did he make, do you know?
Well, the immediate change, the thing that I've found, because not having been through the Bill Hennis period of time, Ron Lake, who worked after me and worked till 10 to 2, one night called Robin at home. I think it was Ron who had this happen to him. And he said, Robin, I've lost my boogie. And Robin had no idea what he was talking about. And the bottom line is that Ron was having a bad night. He just could not get focused on his air shift, and he needed something to snap him back into it, and Robin couldn't do it. Robin softened the station eventually, because when I was on the air, when the first night was, you know, pretty much real high energy and then when I heard Coyote, it's like, okay, Coyote is screaming. I'm real, real high energy. And anybody who's over the age of 13 or 14 is not listening to anybody. So I got laid back at night. I laid way back and just tried to be adult to have somebody older than, you know, the 14-year-old girls listening to me.
Do you remember at that time how different musically WKLO was to Wacky?
Wacky always leaned a little bit country, and KLO always leaned a little bit towards the R&B side. And in this town at that time, we had WLOU, which was Black Radio Station, which was a daytimer. And believe about 5 minutes before they would sign off in the evening, you would start a black set, and you'd usually run it 10, 12 minutes so that black audience turning off LOU and they went off the air would start looking for something black and to be hit us. At one point, we had Daddy D. Humphrey, who had been the program director at WLOU, on the air from 6 to 10 at night, which helped too. This was a market. When I came here in 73, there was not a significant FM radio station. The spring book of 1974, WQHI in Jeffersonville went on the IR. They were automated, but they were top 40. And I think, if I remember correctly, in that spring book of 74, when they came on the air, they spiked like a 5 in the Arbitron. So that was the beginning of the end of the AM band.
All right, Robin Walker is program director. How long was he at the station?
I'm going to say early 73 till sometime in late 75.
And then he was replaced by?
Lee Gray.
Lee Gray had worked at the radio station before.
Right. He'd been at the radio station. He left Louisville and was at WMCA in New York for a while, one of the WMCA good guys. He was at Wacky at the time when he came over as program director. I don't really remember the circumstances under which Robin left. I knew there had been some friction, and a lot of it had to do with numbers. When Lee came over, Ernie Guthrie, too, was a station manager, and Ernie said, you know, I'm interviewing Lee Gray, who was morning man here and been there, and then he said, you're the only other person in contention. At that time, I'd been was a music director and assistant program director, and it's kind of like, I really don't want to be program director of this radio station right now. The spring book of 74, on top of everything else, we had a major tornado in Louisville, but I do remember the 12-plus numbers from the spring of 74. KLO had a 12.9 and Wacky had a 12.8. It doesn't get it much closer than that in any radio market today, and certainly back then. I mean, the battle between WKLO and Wacky was legendary, regardless of where you were in the United States. If you were in broadcasting, you knew about the legends Wacky and KLO.
In 1974, was that the peak of WKLO? Did they do any better than that afterwards?
I don't believe so. When the FM penetration hit this market, first you had High 95, then you had LRS finally rearing its head, and they went to the Slee Abrams Superstars format. That made a dent. Eventually WRKA, which was WNUU at that time, started making a little noise. Anybody who had an FM started making some noise, and the AM numbers continued to dwindle.
What about the ratio between Wacky and WKLO? Did WKLO ever beat Wacky?
We did a couple of times. In fact, in the last book that WKLO had that was head-to-head against Wacky was the spring of 79. That was when the transition book was taking place. We were still KLO at that time. Then it became KJ 100. The fall of 78, we basically blew off the teen audience. We were to 5-4 coming out of the fall book. And everybody else in town in the spring book on the AM band dropped. WKLO came back up to a 7.9 because we did some things that were aimed at getting an adult audience. Got a morning man who I'd been up against in Michigan who somehow magically attracted men. When you're building an adult contemporary radio station, the hardest numbers to get are men numbers.
And who was this?
Jack Hood.
Okay.
He had worked at WTRX in Flint, Michigan. And then when I found him, tracked him down, he was the assistant program director at WJR in Detroit, which at that time was a very big news talk operation, and still is, but not quite the same impact it had back then. And he came down in the early part of the year in 79 as morning man.
All right, I assume that you moved from 6 to 10. That wasn't your only shift on WKLO.
Oh, no. I went from 6 to 10, and then Tom Kennedy, Jim Barnes, as I finally remembered his real name, left. I moved into middays and did middays for the remainder of the time that I was on the air, but I had a couple of periods of time where I was Fleetwood Groover, who was production director, resigned this Friday before. Lee Gray told me that there were some cutbacks, and because of what they were planning to do, that it probably behooved me to be looking for a job. So that weekend, I made a lot of phone calls to a lot of friends, and by Monday morning, I had 7 job offers, one of which was from Bill Hennis in Indianapolis at that time. Kind of like, okay, so I go back in, and I'm in good shape. Mentally, I'm in good shape. I know I'm going in, and I'm going to be able to handle being cut out if that's what they decide to do. And Fleetwood gives his notice, And Fleetwood said, Gary is the only person who goes down to the production studio and keeps track of the way things are supposed to be kept track of down there, and I would recommend that he get the job. So instead of being outsourced, as it were, I ended up being production director for a period of time, and then suddenly became assistant program director to leave. He decided that would be a good thing. And then it was decided for him that he had to come off the air and be a person of management status only.
Why was that?
It was a decision made by corporate, and they wanted their program directors to be strictly program directors. Didn't want them competing with the air staff, wanted them to concentrate on corporate things. The only benefit that he got from that, if I remember correctly, was he became vice president in charge of programming, and it gave him more life insurance.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good.
Yeah, really, you know, good thing.
Well, it's a lot different than it is today, because if you're the program director, you are doing an air shift and probably 10 other things at every radio station.
Exactly. If you're not doing programming and traffic and maybe emptying the garbage cans at the end of the day.
Exactly.
So Lee became the vice president of operations. I was promoted to program director at that time. That would have been January of 78. And then turn around, and Lee leaves. He goes to WBAP in Dallas. You know, Bernie Thompson called me, and he said, Lee has just turned in his notice. He's going to WBAP in Dallas, and you're the program director, and we need to do some serious talking about what we're going to do. So we went through several conversations, and when I worked in Virginia, one of the things that I learned from Jay Blackburn was how to do some real heavy market research. So we did some very heavy market research and decided our niche had to be going after WHAS in the AC market. Met with Charles Sawyer, who was then the owner of Great Trails, and he gave us a three-year guarantee to go towards that format and to have the financial support. The funny thing happened on the way to all of this, and it's if you go to the archives on the 1080 WKLO site, there's a segment that I did with Bob Klein and Gary Griffiths. It fairly covers the last days of WKLO, but long story short, we weren't counting on Charles Sawyer dying in the middle of our plan. Of course, he was 94. Sometimes, you know, hindsight is 20/20.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Didn't plan real ahead for that contingency, but...
I mean, who would have thought a 94-year-old guy would die?
I mean, you would think he'd live forever at that point.
Exactly.
Know? And he was in good health. That was the whole thing. It wasn't a case of saying, this is a sickly old man. This is a man who was in good health but died. But we had gone to AC format, blown off the teams in the fall of 78, and then in the spring of 79, when Charles Sawyer died, eventually Alexander Williams, who was the grandson, took over operations of everything, and he and my boss, Bernie Thompson, had had several conflicts before that. Bernie eventually left, and the day that Bernie was let go, I got a call from Tom Dorsey, who's the newspaper critic for the Louisville Times and Courier-Journal, and he does a story, and I said, you know, my comment to him was, there's no telling what's going to happen now, which that comment didn't surface then. That didn't surface until John Page Auding was brought in as station manager and E. Elvin Davis as consultant and C.C. Matthews as program director. And, you know, 6 weeks down the line, the comment appears in one of Tom Dorsey's columns, and program director WKLO Gary Major said, no telling what's going to happen now. So immediately it hit the paper. I had the paper. I walked into John Page Auding's office. I said that to him the day that Bernie Thompson was let go, and I haven't talked to the man since. I was there 6 years. Tom Dorsey talked to me twice, and the other time was the morning after Elvis Presley died. So It's like, because the Courier-Journal was owned by WHAS Radio and TV at that time, it sort of slanted just a little bit with media columns.
All right, so you were there a good long time. You did a lot of jobs from program director there for a while and taking care of production. You mentioned the production room. Let's talk about Mike Rivers and later Fleetwood Groover and the incredible production suite, which I actually saw one time back in the 70s at WKLO, which was probably the best recording studio for a radio station in town.
Oh, definitely so. Here's the interesting thing. We had a 4-track board, but an 8-track machine. When you needed to do on 5 through 8, you had to change the setup on the deck because your board couldn't feed it all the way through. It was incredible. It was very well planned out. It had not only a announce booth, you also had a band box where you could bring in, if you wanted to bring in an orchestra, you could actually set up probably about a 20-piece orchestra in the studio.
And this was in the basement, right?
In the basement. You know, the only time you ever had a problem was until they carpeted the floor. For a long time, they had a tile floor. If you had a saleswoman or if you had a secretary who wore a stiletto heel, you couldn't be recording voice work while they were walking down the hall.
Okay.
Because it would carry through. That's the only thing that ever bothered it. It was set up production director-wise, when there were issues, it was attended to. It wasn't a case of, well, okay, one channel's out of the board. Well, we'll get it fixed sometime next week. Because you not only had the radio station production, you also had a lot of outside clients. And Mike Rivers, our Wendell Wright, would have people coming in, jingle singers, you know, outside talent. If you were a client and you needed something special to really kick something off, oh, let me sit down and write a jingle for you. I had the most talented production person I ever worked with. When Fleetwood took over, it was more of a case of, we need somebody who can do production. We're not worried about the outside business. We're not worried about the studio people. Because the problem you have when you're doing that, when Mike Rivers was on the air in the afternoon, he would be down in the production studio trying to put together a track for a client that wasn't necessarily a radio station client, but maybe one of his clients, and had to be on the air. And, you know, whoever was on the air middays, and that would be me oftentimes, you know, I'd be on the air 15 minutes later because he'd be downstairs finishing up tracks. He lived two blocks from the radio station when he was on the air in the afternoon. If he had an appointment and he had to get home, you know, last song would maybe, let's say we had Stairway to Heaven today, and we're going to play out the, what, 716? Is that the correct length someplace?
Yeah, there? Something like that, yeah.
So at 5:53, it was on. He was out the door. You'd better be in the studio at 6 o'clock.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when I was in Michigan, we had a radio-TV combo, and occasionally, and you have to really stretch this imagination, but occasionally the afternoon drive guy on the radio station would also have to do the 6 o'clock news. So you'd put on Hey Jude or whatever and put your tie on the way to the studio and grab headlines from somebody who had them to you as you walked in and did the news bump. Then you looked over the newscast. Did that more than once. Got to play TV weatherman more than once on a fill-in basis. Not necessarily a career I ever wanted to do, you know. It's kind of like, well, we need somebody and you're it.
Well, you know, that Mike Rivers was a talented guy, and I was impressed by the actual radio station jingles. You know, WKLO could have gone someplace else, like TM Productions or TAMS, and had their jingles cut.
Right,
but
right.
He actually did a pretty good clone of what TM Productions, who was really hot there in the early 70s, did.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Those jingles you heard, and you can download them from the website, are actually done right there at WKLO, and they sound just as good as what you'd hear in Dallas.
Yeah, definitely. So the last package we had was the Listen to Your City package, which was the AC package that came, I think, from TM. And it was a great package. I have no idea where it ended up. I know that when I left there, the least of my worries was grab the master jingle package, you know.
As far as production is concerned, one other question about that. You got the good production studio downstairs, and then you have a kind of a more conventional production studio upstairs. How did you decide who was going to use which studio?
Most of the time, it was a case of you were assigned production by Mike or by a production director. Most of the time, it was produced upstairs. You were brought into the downstairs studio only usually to do voice work. You didn't have to mix things out. And then when I became production director, it pretty much was a case where you got to come in, do the voice work, and walk away. I worried about the mix-outs.
Okay. All right, so, Robin Walker is a program director. Easy guy to work for?
Yeah, he was. I liked Robin. His background, besides broadcasting, was he was actually at one time in, this is for people who are old enough to remember, Disney and Spinnin' Marty. He was actually in Spinnin' Marty.
Wow.
He was somebody who could ride horses, and that's where he is. Last we knew, he's out someplace in Oldham County, still with horses.
All right. His replacement as program director was Lee Gray, a great guy, very smooth on the air, excellent production skills. As a program director, how was he?
I hate to speak ill of the dead, so I'm not going to go into real long, jaded stories, but as his assistant, there seemed to be a whole lot of things that I implemented because he conveniently scheduled his vacation when something important needed to be kicked off, whether it be a promotion, whether it be prize patrol or whatever. It just seemed that a lot of stuff fell on me. And that could just be from the point of feeling like at that time I was disenchanted with not only broadcasting, just with things in general. I had gone through a divorce and like that. So, you know, it's kind of like I tried to set myself aside from that period of time and where I was in life. I loved listening to Lee, and Lee had radio stories like you wouldn't believe, and was a really a good guy.
But now, wasn't it during that time at WKLO that he made that big spiritual change in his life?
Oh, yeah. He, as he described himself, he was, you know, the original sinner, and then one day he came in. Ty Meredith, who had been news director, led him to the Lord. Ty and Linda did, and Lee came in, and he was a saved Christian man, and anything and everything then became about that to him. And that's not a bad thing. It's just that when you're a rock and roll radio station, the PD comes in and he's a saved Christian, it changes the demeanor of everything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it doesn't have to, but certainly it could have
well,
a situation.
Well, you know, when you get into air check sessions and things that were okay on Friday suddenly become not okay on Monday.
Oh, like suggestive lines and things like that?
My entire life was built around double entendre, so it's like, that transition is hard to make.
Well, it certainly worked out well for him because after he went to Dallas and BAP, he entered a very successful career as a Christian broadcaster, which he worked at until he passed away.
Right, which is great. I mean, I've been in Christian broadcasting now since 99, so I certainly understand that. And Lee did love the Lord. There's no question about that in my mind. And, you know, a lot of people thought I was putting on an act. I never, ever read it that way.
And then who replaced him as program director?
Me.
Okay. And then why did you end up tossing the baton to somebody else?
Well, it wasn't a case of offering the baton. The baton was ripped from my dying, clutching hands, man. We went through the period in the spring of 79. I had Jack Hood, had Tim England, had Rip Reinhart, Steve Avery, let's see, Hutch had come onto the scene at that point towards the end, putting together and making an AC radio station happen. And then the general manager, Bernie Thompson, was unceremoniously relieved of his duties. And the one thing you learn about transitions and things like this is when the company offers you a car, when the company offers you a home, don't take them. Because when you have, on top of everything else, okay, you no longer have your job, and oh yeah, leave the keys to the Buick on the desk when you go.
Oh,
and where
man.
Is it parked? Or in one case, I was offered a job that included a two-bedroom apartment, which is not fun to do when you have two girls and a boy and a wife. Like, no thank you, we're going to have to do something. Otherwise, I can't do that. That comes with the job. But when the change was made and John Page Otting came in as general manager, and then, okay, that's fine one day, and he and I meet, and the next day E. Alvin Davis comes in as the consultant, I know right away, well, I'm not going to be here much longer. And then a couple of days later, C.C. Matthews comes in and is the new program director, and I am then reduced to being a whipping boy for a while, and, you know, a lot of disparaging remarks about my abilities as a program director or the radio station in general. And then at one point, I had a friend that I had made a comment on the air that that she picked up on. I said, "Gee, are you looking for a job?" I said, "Yeah, I need a job." So the company I work for is hiring. Well, that was in industrial supplies. And I went down and interviewed and was hired. And the next day went in and was basically told, "You got 2 weeks to find a job." I said, "Okay, that works. I can do that."
It's amazing when things come together like that.
Yeah, it really is. I've had suffered some periods of unemployment in my life. But it's like that.
Well, you're in radio, so you have to.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. If you're in radio, that's going to happen. There's no question about that. And I did industrial supplies. I did a stupid thing when I was selling industrial supplies because I was so burned out on radio. I just, you know, I'd been in radio at that time 12 years, had had more than one situation that you kind of got lucky on, but, you know, you don't always get lucky. I had a very unceremoniously burning of all my air checks.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. The only air check I have of me at WKLO, in fact, I've only got one other air check that I just ran across recently from QRK. The only one I have is the one that you have on the website from December of 1973.
Oh, man.
It's the only one I have.
Well, I've heard that sad story from so many people. Oh, I threw my air checks out. As a matter of fact, I talked to Mike Rivers shortly before he died, asked him some questions, and he said, "Yeah, I had all that stuff, but, you know, we moved a little while ago, and I looked at the dumpster and looked at having to load it in the van one more time, and I decided to go ahead and throw it all away."
Yep. And I'll tell you what, his stuff would have included some of his classic commercial work, his time frame at CKLW in Detroit and Wibbage in Philly. The one line of his that always sticks with me that got him into the most trouble was, "Mirror, mirror on the ceiling, now I can see what I've been feeling." And Paul Drew, who was program director for Bill Drake at CKLW at the time, did not like that line at all. I had a kid that worked for me up in Michigan that went from being, oh, he was about 20 years old, he went to CKLW for a year. End of a year, they said, "We don't want to renew your contract." So he came back and worked in Michigan, in Saginaw, and he's still up in that area, which that one area you don't want to be in right now is Michigan.
No, no.